Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In a recent conversation with a colleague who happens to be a millennial, he mentioned that he doesn't carry a credit card. This seemed a little unusual. I came of an age in which everyone, it seemed, used plastic, for better or for worse. But recent surveys show many millennials, nearly two-thirds, are leery when it comes to credit. While this might seem a good way to avoid the pitfalls of overextending yourself, some experts say use of credit cards can be important when trying to build a good credit history. If this is your experience, if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. Sean McQuay is with us for the first part of the hour. Sean is NerdWallet's credit card expert and a millennial himself. Welcome to Radio Time, Sean.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's start briefly with statistics. Only about a third of households headed by someone under the age of 35 held some credit card debt as of just a few years ago. And this is from the Survey of Consumer Finances. Is this news to you, Sean?
No, it's not. Like the millennial colleague you mentioned earlier, a lot of us millennials are hesitant to use credit cards. And there's a number of interesting factors behind that, but the fact of the matter is that one means we're carrying less credit card debt, but we're also not enabling ourselves to build up our credit future by not using them.
Well, let's talk about some of the reasons why. Where does student loan debt fit into the narrative?
So student loan debt, I think everyone has seen the news, has been rising in recent years as school has gotten more and more expensive and job prospects for recent graduates have weakened. And so student loan debt is a major factor there, and young people are hesitant to take on more debt, especially what we consider consumer debt on credit cards, by adding a card to the pile.
And you'd mentioned earlier that there were a few factors that are, you know, prompting millennials to shy away from using credit. What are some of the others?
Yeah, one of the big ones is the financial recession and kind of the impact that had on our view of the world. So I vividly remember, I was early in college when the financial recession hit. I remember my father-in-law, or my future father-in-law, sorry, being laid off. I remember a lot of friends and family losing their jobs during that time. We saw in the news entire city blocks going bankrupt. And so we were struck with this deep set fear of credit card debt and really debt in general. And that fear has been debilitating to a degree. Then the other side of this is one of access. And so in addition to fear, laws changed in 2009 that have actually made it more difficult for young people to get credit cards. If for anyone who went to college before 2009, you may remember there used to be booths all over campus offering free Frisbees or free sandwiches in return for a credit card. Those are now illegal.
Well, some parents might say that's a good thing.
I would agree with that. I personally actually did sign up for a credit card in return for a sandwich, and I'm ever grateful for that sandwich. But I do recognize that is a predatory practice and really not good. But on the other hand, it also means that the tables have flipped. So whereas before it was too easy for young people to get credit cards, now it's something young people need to proactively look for. And especially in that fear mindset we were talking about earlier, that's not something really any of us want to take on, not really recognizing the long-term damage that we're inflicting upon ourselves by not taking a credit card.
Let's get back to the fear factor, if you will. Your story kind of reminded me a bit of something that I read recently in the New York Times, profiling a 31-year-old woman in Seattle who says her family lost her college savings in the dot-com crash of the early 2000s. Then her father lost his job, and her sister and brother-in-law lost their house during the Great Recession. And she says, I just don't expect things to unfold or think, well, now I've got it made, because there's always a turn just ahead of you, and you don't know what's around the corner. So it's that sense, I guess, of standing on shifting sand financially.
Absolutely. And when you think about the benefits of credit cards, they're kind of ethereal, right? You're earning somewhere between 1% and 2% rewards for your purchase. You're building your credit. And these are kind of long-term abstract concepts, whereas people are looking at the real-life stories they feel every day, like those you just mentioned, where you can say, you know what, credit cards are not worth it because that debt, that the possibility of going into the sinking sand is far more costly than the possible benefits.
Well, Sean McQuay, we do have a comment from T who says, I'm a millennial. Should I get a store credit card to help build my credit? What would you say to T?
Yeah, I would say that credit cards are very, very important. I readily recognize the fear component, but the fact of the matter is if you use your credit card like a debit card, whereas you never spend more on your credit card than you would out of cash or out of your debit card, you'll be fine, and that means you won't be going to credit card debt. And that also means you'll be building credit long-term, and that's really, really important if we ever think we're going to buy a house or start a business or buy a car, or if we want to rent an apartment. And many, many things in life check our credit, and we need to start building that. And credit cards are the easiest, safest way to do that.
So would you say...
Store card...
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Yeah, so I was going to say store cards are a good entry point. They tend to have a little bit lower requirements for sign-up than many of the mainline credit cards, but they're also not super useful. So there is a trade-off there.
Okay. So would you say it's essential that young people learn how to manage credit cards if they want to be able to make the big purchases down the road?
I do. And because I do think credit in America is really, really important. And when you think about ways of building credit, you can buy a house, you can buy a car, you can take out a personal loan, you can do a student loan. All of those are very big lifelong commitments, or at least multi-year commitments. Whereas a credit card you can use and pay off every single month, and it's actually not affecting your finances in any way.
No, I was just going to say it's tempting when you look at that statement to just pay the minimum.
Yes.
So yes, and that's a no-no?
That is a no-no. And paying the minimums means you will be paying interest with your purchases, and credit card interest rates are averaging around 18% right now, which is a very costly way of getting money. And if people are looking at building their credit, I know it's a common misconception that you need to carry debt on your card. That's not true. You can pay off your card in full every single month, and you'll get all the credit benefits.
Got it. You fought your way out of credit card debt. I read that in your bio. Would you care to share that story?
Yeah. So I graduated college with a wife and a kid. I decided to start my family a little bit early, and that was expensive. I only had a part-time job on campus, and we did rack up debt doing so. And it took about a year out of college to start getting ahead of my debt, where we were actually paying off more than we were taking on. And so it was a long process for me, and it honestly took longer than I expected it to. But I want to say to your listeners that credit card debt in and of itself is not a bad thing. That life happens, that we all make decisions, and we prioritize our finances, and credit cards are great because they allow very flexible prioritization. And then my other message is, when you do have that debt, just chip away at it. I didn't have a magical plan to pay off my credit card debt. I didn't start a second job. I just budgeted and made sure I was setting aside money every single month and put aside any windfalls like a tax break or a year-end bonus and put that directly against my credit card debt. And doing that, it took me about a year and a half to pay it off.
So if you're just starting out with a credit card, then what are the where's the line? What do you not cross if you want to avoid unmanageable debt?
Yeah, so first of all, I'd recommend avoiding debt in the first place on credit cards. And by that, you can just use budgeting apps and just make sure you never, you just spend on your credit card as if it were cash. Another approach is, this works really well if you only have one credit card, just make sure your balance never exceeds what you'd be willing to spend out of your debit amount, your checking balance. So if you think you have $3,000 in your checking account and you would spend no more than $1,000 of that, just make sure your credit card statement doesn't go above $1,000.
Sean McQuay, debit cards seem to have replaced credit cards. What are the negatives here, if any?
So debit cards are great tools. They're very convenient. But there are two big caveats for consumers to remember with those. One, you're not building credit. So if you are interested in building your long-term financial health in America, that requires you to have good credit. Secondly, they're actually not as safe or offer as many consumer protections as credit cards do. So, for example, if someone commits credit card fraud and breaks into your account and makes a purchase, you can make that purchase disappear from your statement more or less immediately. Hmm. On your debit card, because it's tied to your checking account, that money is gone, and you still can prove yourself innocent. But until you do prove yourself innocent, that money is not in your account, which means in the meantime, you may be bouncing checks, missing mortgage payments, and upsetting landlords and hurting your credit.
Okay. Sean, I want to read you a quote from one young man profiled again in a Times article. Jason Town is 32. He works at a private equity firm. cut up his last credit card several years ago. And when he bought his apartment, he chose a foreclosure, paid with money he had in the bank, and says, I don't want to go out and buy, even though that's what society wants me to do. I want to save and invest for the long term. And, you know, that it just struck me that there's something about that that's kind of old-fashioned and sensible in his outlook. Is he onto something there?
I think he is. And for people that have the cash on hand to live like that, I'd strongly recommend it. Taking loans of any sort, whether they be a mortgage, an auto loan, or credit card, is costly. There is an interest side to it. But I do recognize not every American is in a position like that where they can save up to purchase a house outright or wherever they're living. And so I recognize credit is very important for securing a rental agreement with a landlord. I know in San Francisco, even if you're purchasing a house, the people selling the house look for everything they can about you, so they may even still check your credit even then. And employers often do, too.
I want to get into something we're going to discuss with a guest here after the break. But according to FINRA, and this is back to student loan debt, which is one of the reasons many millennials seem to kind of shy away from credit. A quarter of millennials have student loan debt and really didn't know what they were getting into when they signed on. Over half, according to the survey, didn't ask about monthly payments, for instance. When you were coming up, did you have financial literacy classes in high school or in college?
I didn't, not really. I took economics classes in high school, but that was not personal finance.
Were they offered?
Personal finance. No, not that I remember. Hmm. My personal finance teachers were my parents. My dad is the type that if you play Monopoly with him, he's the one mortgaging every single property he owns. And he really taught me the value of debt in that way, that you can leverage what you have to get more than what you have. And debt can enable that. You need to play it smart, and that's really where financial literacy comes in. And I know I was very privileged to have that education that so many Americans don't have access to.
So it's good to have a good financial mentor.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's get one more tweet in from before the break. Julie asks, so how do millennials shop online? Debit cards only? And again, she asks, are they are secure? I know you addressed that a few moments ago. Do you find, I don't know if you have this information, that millennials are using debit cards online as opposed to credit cards?
I don't have the breakdown for online spending, but I do know that many millennials do prefer to use debit cards in general because they feel it's financially savvier and they're able to control their money a little bit more. But like I said earlier, you are losing out a lot on those consumer protections that credit cards offer. So if something does go wrong with the online purchase or if someone breaks into that account, you as a consumer will be much safer if you'd used a credit card than a debit card.
Yeah, if you decide to take on a credit card, pay that bill every month. Pay the whole thing
off
every month.
Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Sean McQuay, it was great to have you with us on Radio Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Sean is a credit card expert with NerdWallet. After the break, we'll talk about financial literacy programs in schools and colleges. Helene Olin of Slate will talk about why she doesn't think they're effective. So anyway, if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number. Keep it here. Radio Times is back in a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. A recent study by the FINRA Investment Education Foundation found that most of us in this country think we know more about money than we really do. 76% of those surveyed last year gave themselves a rating of very high when it comes to financial knowledge, but only 37% could answer 4 out of 5 questions on the survey correctly. How much do we really need to know? And also, are financial literacy programs in schools and higher education effective? 888-477-9499 is the number if you'd like to add your 2 cents. Couldn't help that. Or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We're joined for the next few minutes by Helene Olin, a columnist for Slate and host of the Slate Academy podcast, The United States of Debt. Hi, Helene.
Hi, good morning.
So you say the concept of financial literacy looks good on paper, but it doesn't work. Why not?
I always feel like I'm bad-mouthing apple pie when I talk about this. I took a deep dive into financial literacy a couple of years ago, and what I discovered was what other researchers have discovered, is that it simply does not work. When researchers at Harvard, at MIT, went and looked at the these studies of people who had taken classes versus those who had not, they found that they had not retained any knowledge, that their behaviors were not any different, and they were just simply the latest to find this out. This is well known in the financial literacy field, actually.
Hmm. Well, so, of course, many schools are now offering financial literacy programs, and I brought this up with Sean McQuay a little bit earlier in the program, but according to FINRA, a quarter of millennials have student loan debt. They really didn't know what they were getting into when they took it on. So what are the alternatives?
The alternative is regulating the student loan industry so that millennials aren't sold things they don't understand. Financial literacy is very much a rather cynical attempt to throw blame for the failures of the American economic system onto the individual. And that's why we really started hearing about it in the wake of the 2008 crash. It suddenly became this way of saying, oh, it wasn't the banks that, you know, were, and the mortgage brokers who were selling people on mortgages that they didn't understand, because who on earth is going to read a 100-page, single-space, small-type mortgage document loaded with gotcha terms? It was suddenly that consumers got in over their heads, and they should have read this. And if they had just understood what they were doing, this wouldn't have happened.
Helene, you're also taking aim at a joint financial literacy venture involving the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a federal watchdog, and the Financial Services Roundtable, which is a lobbying organization. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, the CFPB is required to promote financial literacy as part of the Dodd-Frank legislation. In fact, the CFPB did a study a couple of years ago, and they revealed that the banks are spending 25 times as much money on marketing their goods, that is, you know, credit cards, bank accounts, mutual funds, you name it, than they are on financial literacy programs. So what I did was a few years ago, the CFPB did a joint event with the Financial Services Roundtable on financial literacy. And I went in and just took a look at the real financial literacy record of a bunch of the people they were with.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was Discover Cards, which had had all sorts of settlements for selling people on things they shouldn't have. But in my favorite had, I looked up their financial literacy program. And their financial literacy program online actually promoted credit cards as a way of stretching your budget. Which brings us to the bigger problem in financial literacy, which is, what is it exactly? It can pretty much be anything anyone says. There are no real standards.
Yeah. Where do the use of credit cards fit into the average American's life? Where should they fit into, in your opinion?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
How should credit cards fit into the average American's life, in your opinion?
I think it depends on how you want them to fit into your life. I think there's a lot of scolding right now with millennials that they are sort of not taking on credit the way previous generations did.
Mm.
I personally think this is a little bit oversold. One of the reasons millennials have less credit cards than my Gen X generation is actually a fairly basic, again, regulatory one, which is when I went to college, it was very easy to get a credit card on campus.
Yeah.
If you remember, they would just be, you know, they would be promoting them on campus, and pretty much anybody could sign up, and
with
it didn't
frisbees.
Matter that you didn't have a job.
Yeah.
Well, the CARD Act of 2009 changed that. So the result is we suddenly have a generation coming out of college without credit cards. And I think as time goes on, they will acquire credit cards. I mean, it seems very difficult to live in our society without them, but it's certainly quite possible for a few years in your 20s.
Yeah, well, and as Sean McQuay pointed out earlier in the show, the narrative is you need some sort of credit card use to build a good credit card history.
Right, but I will also point out that this wave of millennials is also potentially changing that slightly. And it's actually really interesting, and nobody is still sure where this is going to go, but you are beginning to see the credit bureaus and FICO experimenting with alternative credit scores where they are taking into account people paying their utility bills, people paying their cable bills, people paying their rent. Now, this is an interesting concept because, of course, this isn't debt, right? It isn't revolving money that you can borrow and pay back, but it is showing that you will meet your obligations. And I think the jury is still out on how well this will all work.
Okay, just a couple more items from some of the information that I was reading that you've written. You question the Financial Services Roundtable, the industry group again, and its opposition to a government move to protect consumers regarding individual retirement savings. What's that about?
Oh, this has been an ongoing battle. The Obama administration, through the Department of Labor, is now requiring, as of next year, that when you go to get advice on your retirement accounts, that the advice you get is given in your best interest. Previously, if you did this, if you went and got advice about your IRA, it might be in your best interest, but most financial advisors actually work to something lower called the suitability standard, which means that they could give you advice that is just sort of okay, but will make them more money than you, frankly. And the industry, which is promoting financial literacy, is fighting this change. Now, when people go in and study this, we find repeatedly over and over again that the vast majority of people think any financial advisor they see has a duty to act in their best interest, which is just flat out not true. The vast majority do not. And yes, by the way, you would probably learn this in high school, but it defies belief to think if you take financial literacy class, but it defies belief to imagine that somebody taking this, learning this when they're 17 is going to remember this when they're 30 or 40.
Sure. Well, then how does the education begin? Because the person who is 17 is going to head off perhaps to college or into the workforce. What is the value of a financial mentor? And if there is value, what shape should that take?
Like your previous guest, I tend to think most of us will ultimately learn at home. But there is also a concept called just-in-time education. So, for example, if you're signing up for student loans, somebody who would have a duty to act in your best interest, which, again, is not required right now, would sit down with you and explain this all very carefully. And in fact, there was a study, and it was in one of the states in the Midwest, and I'm forgetting if it was Iowa or Indiana, where the school sent students what loans they were proposing to take out and what their payment would be after they graduated. And sure enough, the amount of money the students, that group of students took out actually was reduced. People saw what they were going to pay, and they were like, oh my God, no, I can't do this. And that's the sort of thing that needs to be done. This isn't so much about you learning as creating a structure where you can get objective, good advice.
Helene Olin, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times. Glad you could join us.
Thank you for having me on.
Helene is a columnist for Slate and host of the Slate Academy podcast, The United States of Debt. We're going to dig some more now into findings from the FINRA Investment Education Foundation. Kent Allison is national leader of PricewaterhouseCoopers Employee Financial Wellness Practice. Welcome to Radio Times, Kent.
Thank you for having me.
So again, the study by FINRA found that 76% of those surveyed last year gave themselves a thumbs up, a real good thumbs up when it comes to financial knowledge. But in reality, just about a third could answer 4 out of 5 questions on the survey correctly. So in your experience, is the average investor overconfident about the nuts and bolts of money management?
I think so. I mean, we find that, you know, many individuals, once you start to kind of quiz them on the basics, their confidence starts to reduce. So I think being, you know, in the U.S. and being the world's richest country leads to a certain complacency or a certain expectation that you do know more. But in reality, when you start to look at where the U.S. ranks, it ranks around 14th in financial literacy. So so there's a definite disconnect between what people actually believe where they are in terms of financial literacy and where they actually are.
So 25,000 people were surveyed by FINRA, and there are a couple of the questions in the survey I'd like to tackle here, one which stymied nearly everyone, was about bond prices and how they respond to rising interest rates. Why is this important for us to know? And after that answer, if you could give us the correct answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think people need to understand, you know, when they invest in bonds, often they're thinking it's a safe investment. And specifically when they invest in, you know, bond mutual funds where they're not actually holding the bond, they need to understand what the reaction is to the value of those bonds or the underlying bonds in a mutual fund to interest rates. So if you're holding a bond and essentially it has low interest rates and interest rates rise, the value of your bond is going to decline because it's no longer as valuable as a new bond that's coming onto the market. So it's extremely important because a lot of people invest in bonds thinking they're safe and secure. And certainly when you hold on to a bond until maturity, you get the full value out. But if, in fact, you're in bond mutual funds and they're buying and selling every day, you're subject to this risk.
All right. Another question on the FINRA survey addressed the concept of compound interest. And if that's not clearly understood, then the credit card user can run into some big trouble. Could you get into that for us?
Yes, I mean, this goes on both the credit card and the savings side of things, mm-hmm. Where people don't understand that essentially interest compounds on top of it. So ultimately what's happening there is that when you have a balance, you're not only paying on that balance, but you're now paying on any interest on top of that balance. So if you only pay off the minimum balance on your credit card, for instance, and you're not really whittling down on the principal balance, there's interest being added to your principal balance each month, and therefore interest on top of that interest continues to compound and your balance never really gets paid off.
Yeah.
Same thing on the positive side with compounding on in a 401k plan. You're not only getting interest on the money you put in, but then when that earns interest, you're also compounding interest on top of that, so you're actually saving more.
Let's get into the basics with credit cards, Kent. How many of us actually read the fine print when applying for a card? And if we don't, how can this get us into trouble?
Well, certainly, if you don't read the fine print, there's various interest rates in the fine print with regard to how much you're paying, not only on the credit card on face, but how long that maybe an introductory rate lasts, and then it turns into the higher rate. Or, if you take cash advances on your credit card, there may be a whole different rate that is much higher. So ultimately, what people do is they get a credit card often on an introductory rate, hold on to it, and then they get in the mail, various times over the course of holding that credit card, notices that they don't read that ultimately tell them their rates have changed.
Uh-huh.
And ultimately, they may be paying higher rates than when they first got into the card. So it's very important to kind of not only read the fine print as to when you're getting that credit card, but also to open up those envelopes when it says changes to terms.
But frankly, if I look at something like that with the legalese, my head starts to swim. And in fact, the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau tried to get credit card companies to edit these agreements a few years back. But apparently the average agreement is still 4,900 words long. So your advice to consumers is what in trying to get through this stuff?
I think you need to, one, pay attention to the statements. Two is that you really, when they, the notices generally that you receive when there is a change generally are a little more simpler. They're normally, two pages front and back. And again, it should be something that you always pick up and open and read, because generally if it's changing, it's probably not to your benefit.
Yeah. So take the time to do it. Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So let's get to some comments. Nell in Havertown says, I'm not a millennial. I am of Generation X. But in my early 20s, I was in some credit card debt. I was able to get into a debt consolidation program from a nonprofit organization where they negotiated a lower rate with my credit card companies to pay off the balances. It took me 5 years, but I paid it off. So Nell's story has a happy ending, even though it took her 5 years to get the job done. But what is the value of debt consolidation programs?
Again, I think she did it the right route. There are, there are good debt consolidation programs and those that, are looking to gain profit through the debt consolidation. So going with a nonprofit that is focused on negotiating with the lenders is a better way than going to some of the ones that are taking fees and essentially, you know, actually causing you more harm by consolidating debt. So she did it the smart route, which is essentially to find a not-for-profit organization that is focused on helping you and ultimately negotiating, you know, rates down so that ultimately things become more manageable.
Kent Ellison, what's a good way to find one of these nonprofit groups, a really good one?
If you Google them, look for a not-for-profit debt consolidation. Consumer credit counseling is one of them, but there are multiple ones out there that you know will promote the fact that they are not-for-profit and there to help you.
Let's get back to the FINRA study. It also looked at millennials in particular and found that when it comes to balancing the books, balancing the budgets, nearly a quarter of them spend more than the money that is brought in. So if the budget doesn't work, what are the long-term consequences?
Well, we've seen in our own studies that ultimately they turn to alternative financial services, so things like payday loans and auto title loans and go to pawn shops, all the things that you shouldn't do, tax refund advances. So it's very difficult when you find yourself in either a situation where your cash is running out before your next paycheck is in, or where we're finding in many circumstances they don't have enough emergency savings put aside to essentially deal with an unexpected expense. So it ends up actually hurting them because they turn to resources that ultimately are not good resources in terms of the fees you'll pay and the interest you'll pay on these short-term alternatives.
The debt load can snowball?
Oh, yes. Yes.
So quickly. If you miss payments on your credit cards, what happens to the credit score?
Well, your credit score ultimately will be impacted by that. So you always want to try to make at least the minimum payment. And then ultimately, if you start to pay down the debt, it obviously is favorable as well.
All right. We're talking about financial literacy this hour of Radio Times. According to a study from FINRA, Americans are confident about money and investment, but it turns out most of us don't know as much as we think we do. Kent Ellison is national leader of PricewaterhouseCoopers employee financial wellness practice, and he is here to offer some insight. If you have any questions, here is the number, 888-477-9499. An email works as well, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Radio Times continues. Just a moment. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are talking about credit and compound interest and bonds and debt and budgeting and more as we focus on financial literacy this hour of Radio Times. Kent Ellison is our guest. He is national leader of PricewaterhouseCoopers employee financial wellness practice. And the telephone number is 888-477-9499. We've got calls and also comments coming into Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And Kent, before we move on, you just mentioned briefly before the break, a rainy day fund. Just quickly, how much do you think should be in an emergency fund?
Generally, they recommend 3 to 6 months of your take-home pay just to get you through any, period of time of uncertainty. That generally goes up with compensation. So those that who have more compensation, if in fact they were unemployed, would be probably unemployed longer. So the more you make, the more you probably should put aside to essentially help you through any periods of downturn or unexpected expenses. But generally, the guideline is 3 to 6 months of personal expenses.
Okay. And a credit card is not considered an emergency fund.
It should not be. Yeah. You should have funds set aside to essentially deal with the situation so that you're not putting yourself in a more of a tangled mess beyond the period.
Kent Allison, the FINRA study also found that millennials in general aren't preparing for the future and are shying away from long-term financial planning. Nearly half do not have a retirement account. 65 is, you know, way in the future for young adults, but I know you're going to say you start now.
Well, definitely start now. But what I think we have is a changing environment where they're confronted with, you know, some significant financial issues that are front and center to them, including student debt. So we're finding that they have too many issues on a day-to-day basis that they're dealing with that does not allow them to even focus on the future. So making sure that they get their cash flow and debt under control is probably the first magnitude of order. And then thereafter, ultimately trying to find savings so you can put it away for the long term. If, in fact, we found in with our employers that they tried to solve the problem by doing automatic enrollment and auto escalation in the 401k plans, but the problem was it's coming out the back end through loans and withdrawals. The reason being is until you solve the problem of their day-to-day cash flow and debt issues, forcing them to save doesn't necessarily solve the problem. It may actually exacerbate the problem.
Okay, so you say it's okay to put it off for a while you get the debt situation under control.
I mean, yes, because ultimately, if you're paying, you know, a certain amount in interest and you're not meeting your day-to-day expenses, you've got, you know, more prominent problems in immediate term. The only thing I would say that's counter to that is if, in fact, the company is giving you free money through a company match in the retirement savings, you want to kind of factor that in and factor that against the interest you may be paying on some of the other, you know, debt that you're in to see which is going to benefit you more.
Quote, unquote, free money, take it.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's get to the phones. Jamie in Philadelphia, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'd like to get Mr. Allison's comments on using a life insurance policy as a tool for building up money for retirement.
Thanks, Jamie.
Kent, what generally, do you think? Yeah, generally, I would recommend using life insurance as an investment vehicle. It's really there as a protection vehicle. There are usually better resources to build up on a tax-deferred basis, including your 401k plan. Naturally, if you're maxing out on tax-deferred vehicles, it is an alternative to try to seek out further tax deferral, but generally, as an investment, life insurance isn't the number one vehicle to invest in to fund retirement. It's generally there to protect you in case something should happen to you and to protect your family.
Thanks, Jamie, for the call to Radio Times. We have an email from Evan who says, if you pay off debt that has been sold to the original debt holder rather than whoever now has it, does that clear your debt for the agencies that monitor this? Kent Allison?
If you pay off your debt, it should clear off the debt and with the agencies that monitor them. So it doesn't matter who owns the debt thereafter. Ultimately, it should show that you've cleared the debt.
So back to millennials for just a moment, Kent Allison. You know, and if they do have the funds to start saving for retirement, they in general they're young enough to afford some higher risk options.
Oh, certainly if you have the time in terms of investment time horizon, you can take additional risk. But I would recommend that you not use anybody else's risk tolerance but your own, meaning that you have to understand what you're getting into and how much risk you're taking and make sure you're comfortable with that risk. Naturally, there are different risks than just stock market risks and fluctuations in the marketplace, including things like inflation risk, where if you don't invest a little aggressively, to earn interest rates that are greater than inflation, your purchasing power is going down. So it doesn't always benefit you to be ultra conservative and not lose the principal, because ultimately you may be losing principal in the end.
I was reading in Forbes today that this generation has grown up in an era of startups. So do you see that there might be a shift from more traditional investments to alternative investments?
Well, I think that you have a generation that certainly is looking for probably a quick win. So certainly, and they've grown up in this environment where they've seen many successes and probably are blind to the multitude of failures. So it's not surprising that people would look towards some of these startups as a means to try to get rich quick. The reality is that it should be probably a smaller percentage of your portfolio that is taking on the greatest risk, and ultimately you should still diversify across a broader range of investments.
Okay, continuing with our calls here on Radio Times, let's get to Stephen in Hopewell. Welcome to Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I want to know why there can be such disparity between the credit scores of the three reporting bureaus.
I'm not familiar with that, but is that something you can speak to, Kent Allison?
Yeah, I mean, each one has their own formula, and you need to understand their formula to understand how the credit scores essentially are evaluated. Most will take not just one of the so when evaluating your credit, they won't just take one credit score. They'll look at multiple agencies and see where you end up. So it really is formula differences that ultimately drive the differences in the numbers. But you should be being evaluated by more than one of those agencies anyway.
So, Kent, what's a simple way for a consumer to look at this then?
Well, there's various, free credit reports services out there that at least will give you your score and you understand where you're at. There are paying services where they'll give you the detail. I believe people should pull their credit report at least once a year just to find out what's going on and to make sure that there's no identity theft or things on your credit report that are being misreported. So you should always, we recommend that you should at least once a year check, if not more often. And there's various sites where you can do it multiple times a year for free.
Stephen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Debbie in Glenside, Pennsylvania, you are next. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Debbie. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, what is less expensive or more economically efficient, a home equity line of credit or a home equity loan in the long run?
Kent?
Well, yeah, I mean, generally a home equity loan will probably give you a more favorable rate in the long term. The flexibility in the home equity line of credit is that you obviously you can pay it off and use it when you need it. So there's a bit of a flexibility. That flexibility sometimes comes at a cost because the rates may vary a little more greatly on the home equity line.
Debbie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We appreciate you checking in with us. Ken Allison, many young people apparently, according to research here, don't know how to write a check. So the value of check writing in this age of everything online and the value of balancing your checkbook. Apparently, these are skills that, are a little bit rusty.
Yes, we've seen that. Then again, in the day of all apps and electronic payment, bill payment, and as such, you start to lose sight of basic banking. That's one of the things that we think should be taught in the K-12 curriculum, so that they come out with that base knowledge of basic banking and credit. So it is something that can quickly get lost as you put things on auto payment and you use the bill paying apps that are becoming more and more abundant.
Kent, Helene Olin pointed out earlier on the show, she's with Slate, that apparently even if this stuff is being taught in school, many young people are not absorbing it. So, where can they learn? One of our callers mentioned that he had, great mentorship at home. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is the fundamental issue with financial literacy. It takes a long time. Like anything else that you learn, if it's not reinforced over and over and over again, it gets lost. So the struggle with those that are proponents of financial literacy are battling this inherent problem with the fact that if it's not reinforced, you lose it. So I believe there's a combination of things that that we are looking at, which is not only trying trying to educate them, but also providing them with tools and resources that help them make smart choices. So at that just-in-time training that your last presenter mentioned, mm-hmm. Is something that we are focused on as well, which is when I have to make a decision, where are the resources to help me make a better decision? So it's not necessarily what I know, but having the available to you at the time you're making decisions, the resources you need, whether that be educational resources or some type of coaching or even social circles and socialization, which we're seeing more and more influences people's decision making.
And again, when we're talking about good resources, are we talking about the public library? Are we talking about looking for personal finance workshops?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on you. The library certainly has resources in there. It takes initiative to go in and essentially find those resources and make sure that they're appropriate resources. When you start to look at the resources that are provided either through the workplace or the appropriate resources online, you can find things probably quicker and they can better match your needs.
All right. Well, let's try to get another telephone call in here before we wrap up. Debbie in, or actually that would be Kate in Ambler. You are live on Radio Times. Hello, Kate.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I am 70 and a half years old, and I'm now facing an RMD. I have two tax-deferred retirement accounts. And as an example, if I have to take 28% out, do I have to take it out of each one, 14% each, or can I take it just out of one? I ask that question because one is returning a higher rate to me than the other one.
Thanks, Kate. Kent, do you have that? Can you address that?
Yeah, you know, there were rule changes just fairly recently about, you know, pulling that out, and I don't have the answer right now. I can probably get back to you, but I do believe that you may have to take it out of both.
All right. Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Kate. And we do have, I do want to get this in, an email from Crystal. How does a large medical debt affect a credit score? She says, I'm unemployed now. Can I simply make a regular payment of $20 or some set amount per month to the medical bill and have it not affect my credit scores? That's something a lot of people are facing.
Yeah, I mean, there are special rules associated with medical expenses that are probably, they impact your credit rating less. You'll see that they go through collection agencies and they're constantly trying to collect those debts, and there's a lot of threats, but it's not as, it doesn't impact your credit rating as much as some of the other debt that you have. But I would definitely, you know, call the people you owe the money to and ultimately try to negotiate a payment plan with them, because ultimately they'd be happy to get the money over a period of time than not to get the money at all.
So most agencies are willing to work with you.
Correct.
All right. And one more comment from Nande, who says you used to be able to get a credit card with a limit of $200, $500, et cetera, which helped the young or those with less control to build credit without running up thousands in debt. Do those still exist? You see anything like that, Kent Allison?
Generally, you have to call the credit card agency and ask them to reduce the amount. Obviously they're trying to get you at a level where, they believe that it is tolerable for you, but that you'll carry balances. So ultimately it's kind of on you to renegotiate that or to ask them for a lower credit limit.
Okay. And finally, you know, if somebody is looking to learn about financial issues, if they're shopping for a financial advisor, what do you look for to make sure you're with the right person?
One, make sure you have referrals. You want to hear from others that they've had a good experience, and the more you know the individual that is making that referral, the better off it is. Two is you want to check. I mean, there are online various resources that will tell you whether the individual has any issues with regard to prior issues from a standpoint of breaking any laws or causing any issues. But so it's basically do your research. I always generally recommend that you try to look for somebody who's independent and objective, that's not looking to sell you anything, because you'll probably get better advice. You may have to pay for that advice, but in the end, you won't be paying, you know, on the back end where they've gotten you into, you know, products with high commissions.
Well, Kent Allison, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mary.
Kent is a national leader of PricewaterhouseCoopers Employee Financial Wellness Practice. And I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for listening to Radio Times.